We're going to be going over a several-week study on the intertestamental period. It's actually a period of time that I've never done a dedicated study on. So as I was diving into this, it was really, really great, the amount of stuff that I learned. That outline is very truncated that I gave you. It's not even necessary. So for folks online, you're not really missing anything with not having the outline. I'll try to make sure I put it like on the Facebook page or something for next week. But I'm pretty fascinated by history, as y'all know. So I went on a really deep dive with this, and I probably have about 30 to 40 pages of material just for the first lesson, which is going to go over a couple of weeks. We will not go over all of that. A lot of that stuff is for jumping off points that we'll be doing a little bit later on. But the reason this period is so important, I mean, when we end with Malachi and with, you know, Nehemiah, we've got the Persians in control. We've got the Jews coming back from captivity, taking their residency back up in Jerusalem. And we see a very small area, very small people. When we open up the pages of Matthew and Luke, now we see Judah or Judea, Samaria, Galilee. We see an incredible temple that was built. We see kings like Herod. We see governors. We see all kinds of things have changed. And now there's this, you know, there's this area of Samaria that's got these people that are hostile to the Jews in Judah and in Galilee. And then we have this whole new area called Galilee that we never even heard of back in the Old Testament. And then we've got these other regions like the Decapolis and, you know, which is, you know, mainly Gentile area, but still in the tribal borders of where Israel would be. And you go back and you think, it's like, what in the world happened? Well, it's about 400 years of straight up tumult that happened. In that 400 years, you go from the Persians to the Greeks to independent rule to Rome. And you see the reestablishment of a kingship that mixed with the priesthood. I find this incredibly interesting. We see, you know, one of the greatest pieces of history of deliverance in the Israelite nation was the Maccabean revolt. You know, obviously it pales in comparison to things like the Exodus and those types of things, but still the hand of God was there. And we've got a lot of history from that time frame. First and second Maccabees, you know, even though it's in the Apocrypha and some people view it as canonical, it's not, but it's still great history. We have Josephus, who gave a lot of history during this time frame, especially an incredible account of what happened when Alexander the Great was on his major lightning-fast conquest of the world, and he stops at Jerusalem, and he doesn't destroy him. Why did that not happen, right? Some incredible things take place. So even though it's history, I'm going to try to make it interesting, and hopefully you find it interesting. But my goal is to help us see a little bit more clarity what the time of the New Testament was like culturally when we get into the Gospels and why we see things the way that they are in that time frame. So a tremendous shift takes place, and hopefully we'll be able to go through that. So we're going to start off by talking about the Persian period, because, you know, we get a little bit of information about the Persian period, obviously through Ezra, Nehemiah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, but mainly through Ezra and Nehemiah, we get that, you know, what's actually taking place there. So the Persian period lasted from 538, 539 to about 333 BC. So roughly about 200 years. So think about this for a second. So remember how I said 400 years was flat out crazy? 200 of those years were stable. So you go in 200 years. Now think about it, that's less than the history of the United States. You go from Persia to Greece to independent to Roman rule. That's a lot, right? That's a lot. And you go from having a Jewish culture to having a tremendously intermixed culture with all different kinds of other people groups involved. It's pretty interesting. Now, the Persian story begins with an unprecedented moment. Now, typically, what happens when a nation comes in and conquers another nation? What happens to those inhabitants like we see in the Bible times? They get deported. Yep. They get deported. You know what Cyrus did when he came in? Well, we know. What Cyrus did when he came in and conquered? He sent him back. We have something called the Cyrus Cylinder, and it was discovered in 1879, and this was their process. He says, I returned the images of the gods to their sanctuary. I gathered all their inhabitants and returned to their settlements. I permitted all to dwell in peace. So this is one of the reasons why in Isaiah 44 and 45, he calls Cyrus his anointed, because we have his own words in the Cyrus Cylinder, which match. Let's go over to Ezra chapter 1. It matches what Ezra says. Ezra chapter 1, verse 1. It says, now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he sent a proclamation throughout all his kingdom, and also put it in writing, saying, thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has appointed me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever there is among you of all his people, may his God be with him. Let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and rebuild the house of the Lord, the God of Israel. He is the God who is in Jerusalem. Every survivor at whatever place he may live, let men of that place support him with silver and gold, with goods and cattle, together with a freewill offering for the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. So now we've got kingly support, kingly directive. We've got royal financing as well. When the king says, hey, you guys, give a free will offering. Is that really a free will offering? Not really. It's not. But, you know, it's still something that is, you know, backed by the throne. So interesting. We've got Ezra and we've got the Cyrus Cylinder agreeing. Now, so they end up taking off. They end up going back. And now what we're going to do is talk about the reconstruction, but in several different ways. So what was the impact to Jewish society under Persian rule? Let's look at the political reconstruction first. So what they did is they organized the nation into satraps, or they had them under satraps. Satraps were government officials. They were called satrapies. And there was about 20 to 30 of them, possibly. They increased or decreased. So think of them like provinces. But then inside that area that a satrap was over, what they had was provinces. They had provinces that were there that were underneath there. And what we see is Nehemiah was the governor of the Jewish province. And the name of the satrapy was the area beyond the river. So that was a huge geographical area. And so they needed to make sure they had people in trusted positions. And so what Nehemiah did, he was the governor of the province of Judah, but he answered to a satrap who answered to the king. So that's the chain of events there. And he was there from 445 to 433, roughly. Here's what we find from archaeological digs and as well as, you know, documents. Archaeological evidence shows a complex system. They have discovered tax receipts written in Aramaic, Hebrew, and Greek. Okay, now the Greek ones were a little bit later, but primarily we're dealing with Hebrew and Aramaic. Now, this sets the stage for something really interesting. Okay, this sets the stage for something really interesting. You've got the main language for commerce as Aramaic. So the Assyrians and the Babylonians both used Aramaic. The other language that the Babylonians used was something called Akkadian. But they used Akkadian primarily for their religious observances. they used Aramaic for commerce. So you have the Jews, when they're over in captivity, all of them are learning Aramaic. That's the language that they primarily learned. They still had some Hebrew, but it wasn't widely known. We know this from looking at the book of Ezra, when he has them stand out, and this is actually the podcast getting released this week. It's one of the great proofs of a canon that was dated previous to Ezra. Because think about it. All the liberal scholars say that the canon wasn't or the Old Testament wasn't written and formed until the time of the post-exilic period. Ezra had a copy of the law, and they had to translate it into the language of the people. So let's ask a question. If they had the book of the law, and Ezra's the one that wrote it, why'd they have to translate it? It's because it's called the Law of Moses. Moses wrote it in Hebrew, and they didn't know Hebrew. They knew Aramaic. So it had to be translated. So guess how much evidence the progressives have for saying that Ezra wrote it and it didn't exist before then? Zero. Guess how much archaeological evidence, you know, things like this, documentary evidence that we have, it's all over the place in the Old Testament. That the actual law was written down and predated Ezra by 1,000 years. It's really interesting. It's really interesting. But we get into that into the podcast. I won't get into that now. So they had the temple tax and the imperial tax separated. So they had the ability to tax for the temple, and it was separate funds from the imperial tax. This is part of the great freedom that the Persians offered the people that were subject to them. Unprecedented, which, as a matter of fact, we'll see one of the things that caused the Great Revolution, the Maccabean Revolt, was a raiding of the temple treasury by Antiochus Epiphanes IV. So they had local tax collectors were appointed. You wonder, where did the tax collectors come from? Did they start in Rome? They didn't start with Rome. They started back here in the Persian period. The tax collector system started back here in the Persian period. And so you can imagine how popular they were. But again, they were viewed as agents of a foreign power that were coming in and ripping off their fellow Jews. Administrative authority. So you can see in Nehemiah's records in chapter 7, we won't go there, but he talks about how he appointed city officials by family groups. He established guard rotations for the city walls, managed census records, managed land disputes between returning exiles. So all of the thing, there was a complex administrative system that was being set up in the time of Nehemiah that actually moved all the way through to the different governments that were established. And then you also see military organization. There was a local militia system organized by families. There's actually been weapons caches discovered with Persian armories, Persian-era armories that they have found, watchtowers built, and training grounds established. So not only did the people there have autonomy, they had the ability to form a local militia that was well-armed by the government to provide for local protection. But it was never big enough, from my understanding, it was never big enough to mount any kind of a threat. It was there to provide for local defense. But if you had any one of these little provinces that decided to rebel, the satrap would send in an imperial army and take care of business. Interaction with Persian authority. So you have the satraps. Again, like I said, 20 to 30 satraps were provided. They had an annual tribute of 20,000 pounds of silver. Now, that sounds like a lot. It's about $7.5 million today. Now, you think about how little that province was. They're coming back. They're getting established. We know what the situation was like during the time of Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. It was a little bit rough, wasn't it? And imagine having a $7.5 million tribute that had to be paid hanging over your head. That's pretty heavy. That's pretty heavy. Military movement, anything that the military did, the local military did, had to have Persian authority. They had interprovincial trade that was regulated. and regular reports to the Persian capital. So we see an intricate weaving in of the systems that you would expect to see with an advanced empire. Now, this is the part that I thought was interesting. We're going to talk about the religious restructuring, revival and restructuring. The temple reconstruction. So we know this from the scriptures. I'm not going to dive into this quite a bit. You had cedar beams from Lebanon. You had stone blocks from royal quarries. You can still see those quarries today. Gold vessels returned from Babylon. And then the freewill offering that Cyrus demanded for the temple. The temple administration, they organized 24 priestly courses. They created a temple treasury system. They've discovered treasury seals from this time frame. They've established a temple guard rotation and developed their ritual purification systems. Now, that's all stuff that we know. What I found interesting, oh, and by the way, anybody got any questions, feel free to interrupt me and jump on in. One of the things I thought was interesting is this is when the synagogue system was started. Because you end in Malachi and Haggai, and we've got a temple, and you think it's going to be organized the same way that it was during the pre-Babylonian time frame. But then you come to the New Testament, and you see there's all these synagogues. When did they start? They started during the Persian period. Again, it was a brilliant move on the part of Ezra. Now, number one, did the law authorize synagogues? No. But Ezra, they look back and they see Ezra as the founder of this. And so what he recognized is that the people didn't know. I mean, when he's up there reading the law and having to translate it and having to teach the people what it means, he recognizes that the people don't have an understanding of the law. And he knows that if they're going to avoid what happened to them in 586 with the Babylonian destruction, this needs to be a people that are always aware of the law and what it means. And so what do you find when we get to the time of Christ? People that knew the law. But like all good intentions, the synagogue was great. But it started to evolve with the leaders that got put, that were created as a result, mainly the Pharisees and the Sadducees. All started off good. Well, kind of. Turned into something horrible, didn't it? But think about how important the synagogue system was to the spread of Christianity among the Jewish people in the time of Christ. It was incredibly important. Jesus found himself in the synagogue. So what we see is Jesus using the system that was set up by Ezra during the Persian period as a way to get his message across. Sometimes things in the synagogue went good. Sometimes the things in the synagogue went bad. But he used it for the purpose of getting the message out. And Paul, what's the first thing he always did when he went to a new place? Went to a synagogue. Sometimes it went okay. It went good, like with the Bereans. Sometimes it didn't go so well. And sometimes places didn't have synagogues, but they would meet at the river or at a central place in the city, and Paul would go and find people like he did with Lydia. So there's really great things that came as a result of this that increased the knowledge of the Word of God to allow people to recognize who the Messiah was going to be. And that's why everything spread so fast among the Jews. I primarily bring it back, and this is my opinion, I think that the synagogue training is key to having a people who were biblically literate to recognize who the Messiah was going to be, as the apostles explained through the Spirit after the day of Pentecost. I think that's really cool. But they find Persian era synagogues, reading platforms for the Torah, benches arranged for community seating, storage place for scrolls. The other thing that came about during this time frame, the scribal system. Now, I have a separate study on that, and we'll get into that in a couple of weeks. But the scribal system was incredibly complex. Their processes were incredibly complex. The training that went involved was very thorough and intricate. So much so that we know that the Dead Sea Scrolls that are found really don't have a lot of changes for 1,000 years until we have the Masoretic Text, which is the oldest Hebrew copies we have after the Dead Sea Scrolls. Because the Jewish system, the scribal system, was so exact. Now, I don't find that to be a mistake. That's, again, another, you know, looking at the past, that's a hand to God thing. Why did they do that? Remember Josiah? What did he find during the cleaning of the temple? The law. The lost book of the law. He'd never heard it before, because what did he do when it was read to him? He ripped his clothes and ordered a nationwide repentance. Man, he dug up the bones of the false prophets and burned them on their altars. That's how serious the guy was. They lost it. And Ezra made, and the people after him, made the commitment of two things. So a lot of times we think of Ezra, we think, okay, here's a guy that came back and, you know, he did some good things. He was a great guy. He was a great man. He established two systems, synagogue and the scribes. Or at least I think they can be traced back to him. So that the people would know the law and they'd have access to it. And we know, looking at our history, how important is it that we have the Bible in a language that we understand? I mean, I'm really thankful for the people that lost their lives to make sure that we have the Bible in the common tongue. Because that broke us free from the shackles of Catholicism, which doesn't save anybody. So, I'm very happy for what Ezra and Nehemiah did during these times in the religious area. Questions or comments on any of that stuff? Okay. Cultural, social transformation. Language changes. Aramaic became the administrative language. Official documents were in Aramaic. Business contracts were in Aramaic. Public inscriptions were in Aramaic. Personal letters a lot of times were in Aramaic. And we have about half to two-thirds of the book of, well, I'd say about half of the book of Daniel written in Aramaic. And you have big sections of Ezra that were written in Aramaic. So that's where we get, you know, the Bible was written in three languages. Now, Hebrew was maintained for religious purposes. The Torah scrolls, religious inscriptions, priestly records, ritual objects were written in Hebrew. Now, this is interesting. Now, when Jeremiah was going through Acts, when Paul was in the temple and there was the huge mob and they were beating him, when he started making his defense, what happened? What language did he use? Hebrew. And what did they do when he was speaking Hebrew? They got quiet because people didn't speak Hebrew very much. They recognized that he was an educated religious man and they needed to pay attention when they heard that tongue because people spoke Aramaic mostly. They did Greek for commercial transactions because it was the language that was known throughout everywhere. But Aramaic was the common tongue. But when he spoke Hebrew, Paul knew what he was doing to get people's attention. Everybody got quiet and he was able to present his defense. And as soon as he got to the Gentiles, they were listening, but as soon as he got to the Gentiles, they're done with him, weren't they? So interesting stuff. Social organization. We see genealogies, land distributed by families, responsibilities assigned by clan, and community leadership was hereditary. And we see that structure going back into place. So that's it for the Persian time frame. So that's 200 years. And we did that in Okay, like 30 minutes. That was great. Questions on the Persian period? Okay. Let's move to the Hellenistic transformation. And this one, I will need a picture. I was reading Josephus yesterday, and I found the actual account. Whoops. Find it right. One. There we go. Because I want to read what Josephus writes here in a second. So what we see is the time of Alexander the Great was only 10 years, 333 to 323. And his conquest of going from Greece all the way to India, down into Egypt, took 10 years. How long were we in Afghanistan? How long were we in Iraq? Vietnam, Korea, right? 10 years. And these aren't small places he's knocking over either. I mean, the guy was amazing as a military tactician. So Alexander defeated Darius III at the Battle of Issus in 333, and that changed everything for Israel. So Josephus describes Alexander's visit, and I just want to read this to you direct from Josephus. Let me make this a little bit bigger. It says, and forgive me if I stutter a little bit. This is a little bit blurry on my phone. And when he understood that he was not far from the city, this is Alexander, he went out in procession. Oh no, so it's the high priest. Sorry, he went out in procession with the priests and the multitude of the citizens. The procession was venerable, and the manner of it different than that of other nations. It reached to a place called Sapha, which name, translated into Greek, signifies a prospect. For you have thence a prospect both of Jerusalem and of the temple, so a view. And when the Phoenicians and the Chaldeans followed him, they thought that they would have liberty to plunder the city, to torment the high priest to death, which the king's displeasure fairly promised them, and the very reverse of it happened. So you have these Chaldeans and these Phoenicians who were in Alexander's army. They're following Alexander as he's going in procession, and he sees Jerusalem and the temple, and the Phoenicians and the Chaldeans are all excited because they think they're going to go in and they're going to just destroy everything. And Alexander was bent on it too. He promised them that. So what changed? Check this out, man. This is super cool. For Alexander, when he saw the multitude at a distance in white garments, while the priest stood clothed with fine linen, and the high priest in purple and scarlet clothing, with his mitre on his head, having the golden plate on which the name of God was engraved, he approached by himself and adored that name and first saluted the high priest. So what he did is he came and he actually bowed down before the high priest. Now, let me tell you something. For a Greek king to bow down, it didn't happen. Alexander's army almost revolted against him because he demanded that they proskuneo, that they bow down before him. And they wouldn't do it. But here's Alexander bowing down to the high priest and all of the other priests in priestly garb when he was going there bent on destroying it. And he did it after he saw them. What in the world's going on? The Jews also did all together with one voice salute Alexander and encompass about him. Whereupon the kings of Syria and the rest were surprised at what Alexander had done and supposed him disordered in his mind. So, here, you've got the priest saluting and the high priest saluting Alexander, and then they encompass him. That's a little dangerous, don't you think? So Alexander's up there with some of his officials. His army's behind him. He bows down. They salute Alexander. And then the Hebrew or the Jewish priests surround him. I'm surprised that didn't start a conflict right there. Right? And so the king, the other kings that were with him thought that he was crazy. Because 5 minutes ago, he was going to destroy the place. However, Parmenio alone went up to him, one of his generals or administrators, and asked him how it came to pass that when all others adored him, he should adore the high priest of the Jews. To whom he replied, I did not adore him, but that God who hath honored him with that high priesthood. And here's why he did it. For I saw this very person in a dream, in this very habit, dress, when I was in Dios in Macedonia, who, when I was considering with myself how I might obtain the dominion of Asia, exhorted me to make no delay, but boldly pass over the sea thither, for that he would conduct my army and would give me the dominion over the Persians. Whence it is that having seen no other in that habit, and now seeing this person in it, and remembering that vision and exhortation which I had in my dream, I believe that I bring this army under the divine conduct, and shall therewith conquer Darius and destroy the power of the Persians, and that all things will succeed according to what is in my own mind. That's super cool, man. So, to translate Josephus, there's a whences and thithers, habits. He saw a vision of Jaddua, the high priest, when he was all the way back in Macedonia, when he was considering what to do. And that voice, that person told him, go and you will conquer. And he said, I just now remembered it when I saw him because I've never seen anybody dress like that. Because a Jewish high priest is going to dress very differently than anybody else. And he says, so I remembered that dream. And that's why he hit the deck. And he says, I wasn't honoring him. I was, because he recognized God was at work. Now I want you to think about something. So what happened as a result? They take Alexander by the hand. They bring him into Jerusalem. They show him the book of Daniel, which prophesied about him. And then he offers sacrifices to the priests. What was Alexander going to do to that city? Wipe it off the face of the earth. Because that's what he did. What would that have done? Who knows what that could have done? Who knows what that could have derailed? It could have destroyed everything. He could have wiped out the line of Judah. He could have wiped out the priesthood. He could have wiped out the temple. And reestablished, if he didn't, put it this way, if he didn't do this and allow the Jews to still have religious autonomy, he would have wiped them out, elevated a temple of Jupiter, or Zeus. Zeus would be better, because that's the Greek side. A temple of Zeus on the Temple Mount, and that's it. Story over. It would have become like Alexandria, Egypt, or all the other places named Alexandria that he founded. But no. Because I believe God appeared to him in a vision and showed him the high priest and gave him a prophecy of what he was going to do, because Daniel had the prophecy of what he was going to do. So why wouldn't he give it to Alexander too? He goes in and recognizes that God is with Jerusalem. God is with the Jews. God is there at that temple. And so the last thing he's going to do is destroy it. That is fantastic. That's a God sighting right there. And what's interesting, this is Josephus. He's a very accurate, within a few hundred years of his life, he is a very accurate historian. And this is the account that had been passed down. And remember, this is, yeah, it's 300 years, 400 years. No, somewhere over there, about 350. By the time Josephus writes it. But something had to happen. Because again, he was bent on destroying it. He destroyed everything else around there. And here's Jerusalem completely saved. So I find that really interesting. Thoughts or comments on that before we move on? Anybody else? Is that a new story or have you all heard that story before? You forgot about the dream? Yeah. Yeah, it's such a cool story, and I love the way Josephus records it. Josephus is a good read if you ever get a chance to grab. I've got all of his writings in one book, and I like to read it. It's pretty interesting stuff. Let's see. So what took place after that? So the immediate Hellenization of Judah starts taking place. Now remember, what was Alexander's goal? According to Plutarch, it was the complete Hellenization of the world. In other words, he came in to bring Greek culture, Greek language, Greek religion, Greek economy. In other words, make the world Greece. Still gave people a little bit of freedom, but mainly was making the world Greece. That would not bode well for Jerusalem if he actually did that, would it? To wipe off their culture from the face of the earth, that would not bode well. To turn them completely pagan, where's the Messiah going to come from? So this was the only way, that dream was the only way to preserve the Jewish culture fully under Greek rule. Now, the archaeological evidence confirms the cultural mixing. Now, but that doesn't mean that this was all a good thing. Really bad stuff happened with the Hellenization, the cultural changes, because even, remember, Alexander only lived 10 years. Well, I'm sorry. He lived 10 years during his conquest period. So he died shortly after this, within a decade. And then his generals took over and they didn't abide by this. Okay. So the archaeological evidence confirms a lot of cultural mixing. So we see Greek style coins with Jewish motifs, bilingual inscriptions, mixed architectural styles, Greek pottery and Jewish contexts. So here are the changes that Alexander made immediately. Greek became the official language, which thank you, New Testament, right? I'm so glad the New Testament's written in Greek. It's the perfect language for it to be written in. So we see administrative documents in Greek, official correspondence was bilingual, Greek-speaking officials appointed, translation services established. The urban development. Archaeological evidence shows rapid changes here as well. Greek-style architecture introduced. So you have the Agora marketplace was constructed. And this is a big thing, we'll get into this when we get into Antiochus, they constructed a gymnasium right near the temple. Now you think, okay, cool. Go play some basketball. Maybe go lift some weights. You know, go run around the track a little bit. It's great for physical fitness. Problem is, there was all kinds of really bad stuff that happened in the gymnasium. And since it was right next to the temple mount, it really offended the Jews because the Greeks like to do their exercise au naturel. Thank you, Diane. Unfettered. Unfettered. That's a good way to put it. And man, did that really bother the Jewish modesty sensibilities. So, and again, there were pagan aspects to that. There were idols in those types of things. And to have it right next to the temple, it caused all kinds of problems during the reign of Antiochus. So, but that's, that was the tip of the iceberg, but it was still pretty big. They had colonnaded streets, public buildings with Greek features, and there were educational transformations. Now, again, that gymnasium became a central institution. It was purpose-built facilities, exercise areas with seating equipment, lecture halls with tiered seating, libraries with scroll storage systems, training rooms, curriculum, Greek literature fragments, writing implements, and the social status High-ranking Jewish officials had the ability to become Greek citizens. And that was used to further move the culture over into the Greek side, because that citizenship came with tremendous opportunities. Remember how important Roman citizenship was during the days of Paul. It helped him out quite a bit. So citizenship was offered. There were tax distinctions with Greek citizenship. And then what you see, and this carries its way over into the New Testament, you have a new elite class that was established because of all the wealth that came in through the Greek system. So mixed Greek Jewish names on property deeds, luxury goods in Jewish homes, Greek style decoration in Jewish contexts, and international trade connections. So all of these things come in and they create this like upper echelon of Jewish elite that you still see in the New Testament. And the Sadducees became a part of that elite. They were the rich ones. The Pharisees were a little bit more on the common side. The Sadducees were definitely more on the rich side, and the priests definitely so, as we see with Jesus cleansing the temple. You know, that impacted the priests directly in their ability to make money. So after 323, we'll end here. What we have after this is after Alexander died, you have the Wars of the Diadochi, I think is how it's pronounced. In other words, there were four major generals that Alexander had: Lysimachus, Cassander, Ptolemy, and Seleucid. And there was a huge civil war that erupted that lasted years and years and years. The two that we're going to be in most interested in are the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. All right. Anybody know who the Ptolemies ruled in Egypt. The Seleucids reigned more up north. Anybody know who the last Ptolemy to reign was? Pretty famous. It was a lady out of Egypt, Cleopatra. Cleopatra was the last Ptolemy to rule. And that actually plays directly into how Herod became king and had the ability to kill the infants in Jerusalem. Cleopatra, Mark Antony, Octavian Caesar, or Octavia Augustus was completely involved in that. So, all right, we'll go ahead and stop there. We'll pick up, because this is where I think it gets really interesting, is the Ptolemaic control that starts after Alexander and the transfer over to the Seleucids. And that's where the Maccabean Revolt takes place. So we're going to get into the super turbocharged, action-packed part of the history after that. Anybody got any questions, comments, as we wrap it up?